This is the B-17F Flying Fortress. The B-17 was the backbone of the Allied bombing campaigns over Europe during World War II. It was renowned for its daring daylight missions. The crews endured severe losses while spearheading the tactics that helped lead to the Axis defeat. My name is David Webb, and this is Blue Paw Print. The aircraft was 74 feet 9 inches long, and on the ground, it was 19 feet 1 inches tall. The wingspan of 103 feet 9 inches is around 3 feet shorter than a modern Boeing 737. The skin of the plane was stressed duralumin. This stressed skin was notably thin, with a thickness of somewhere around 1/50th of an inch, which is about 3 to 4 times thicker than standard household foil. Beneath its slender exterior lay a robust airframe. The fuselage was reinforced with formers and longerons. The wings featured a more intricate design with a twin longeron structure, supported by multiple trusses. On top of this was corrugated aluminum sheeting, and then an outer skin of thin duralumin. The control surfaces were covered with doped fabric. The B-17F was no lightweight, and empty, the aircraft weighed around 34,000 pounds. It was designed for a maximum takeoff weight of 65,000 pounds. However, if the aircraft was pushed to its absolute limit, it could take off with a weight of up to 72,000 pounds. When built, the fuselage was made up of several sections. Each section was given a number. At the front was section 41, which housed the plexiglass nose and the bombardiers and navigator stations. It could be equipped with up to 4 machine guns. Next was section 42, which encompassed the flight deck and forward entrance hatch, containing the pilots and co-pilot stations, alongside all flight controls and instruments. On the top of this section sat a dorsal turret, which could be manned by the engineer. It was armed with twin 50 caliber machine guns. Next was section 43, a space dedicated to the bomb bay. Section 44 housed the radio and ball turret compartment. The radio compartment housed a .50 Browning machine gun, and it provided additional defense against the foes attacking from above. There was a ball turret armed with 2 .50 Brownings cramped inside the ball alongside the ammo and the gunner. We'll talk more about the ball turret in a dedicated video. Section 46 was the waist section, offering positions for 2 waist gunners, each of them manned with 1 50 cal that was firing through the waist window. On our model of B-17, these windows were set one across another. So in this tight space, gunners sometimes got in the way of each other during the fight. This problem was solved only on the next model of B-17. Section 47 and 49 were known as the Stinger and encompassed the tail wheel assembly and primary components of the rudder and elevators, as well as a tail gun enclosure. Here, the tail gunner handled a twin 0.50 Browning machine gun. Then, section 48 completed the tail assembly and included the large vertical stabilizer and rudder. The aircraft was manned by a crew of 10, and the most important position was the commander.
Power reduction.
The co-pilot served as the executive officer and was the commander's extension, ready to assume control and responsibilities whenever necessary. There was an engineer, and he was tasked with a variety of roles, from monitoring engine operation and fuel consumption with the co-pilot to ensuring the armament's readiness. The engineer also worked closely with both the co-pilot and bombardier, managing bomb racks and maintaining the aircraft's arsenal.
All good, Taylor. Time to man that gun.
To repel the attacks of enemy fighters, he had at his disposal a dorsal turret armed with 2.50 caliber Brownings.
Navigator to pilot, 20 minutes to the target.
There was a navigator, and he was tasked with charting the route using dead reckoning, radio, and celestial navigation, as well as continuously calculating and guiding the bomber's position from departure to destination and back. He could also man a 0.50 caliber gun in one of the windows in the left or right side of the nose when necessary. The bombardier's task was singular, yet far from simple: the delivery of ordnance on target. Every other function of the aircraft and crew served this ultimate goal. He could also man the guns installed in the plexiglass nose. A radio operator who could also man a 0.50 caliber gun stowed under the roof of his compartment. The gun would need to be pointed out of the roof window in the event of a fight. There were also several dedicated gunners that we'll go through later in the film, tasked with defending the flying fortress against the enemy fighter attack.
Ball turret to pilot. Black dead ahead. Hold on, men.
The aircraft was fortified with armor plates, strategically placed all across the plane and mounted on rubber padding. These plates, made of thin manganese steel, were primarily designed to shield the crew and critical equipment from shrapnel. They also offered some protection against 30 caliber bullets, but their capability to withstand direct hits from large caliber projectiles was limited. Given the light armor and thin skin of the B-17, pilots were recommended to change course for at least 30 degrees for 10 seconds every 40 seconds when flying through flak. Anti-air crews on the ground would try and estimate the position of the plane for when the flak reached the correct altitude. With the planes moving in a somewhat random manner, the B-17 crews could reduce the number of on-target hits. But when flying in formation, things could easily get out of hand. Such movements done without synchronization between the planes would lead to collisions.
There's a fort on top of us! Damn it, Taylor, where are you?
So course and elevation changes were done by following the maneuvers of the lead plane in the formation.
That was close.
The B-17F's primary offensive capability was delivered through its bomb load, capable of carrying up to 8 1,000-pound bombs internally, with additional capacity for 2 rarely used external underwing pylons. The maximum bomb load of 9,600 pounds significantly limited the B-17F's combat range. At full bomb load, the aircraft's combat range was so reduced that it could not reliably reach strategic targets in either the European or Pacific theaters. Optimal load calculations were therefore a critical part of mission planning. Typically, a bomb load ranging from 4,000 to 6,000 pounds allowed for a combat range of 1,300 to 1,400 miles. As the aircraft approached the target zone, the pilot would engage the autopilot.
Autopilot on. Bombardier, it's your fort.
Passing control of the aircraft to the bombardier.
Bombay doors open.
This was a very dangerous time for the crew, as it gave the flak batteries on the ground ample time to target the B-17s as they flew straight and level. The bombardier would use his Norden bombsight, which incorporated gyroscopes and a mechanical computer, which calculated adjustments for height, speed, wind speed, and bearing. When the bombardier saw the crosshairs over the target, he would drop the bombs and report bombs away.
Bombs out, pilot, it's your plane.
The pilot would then regain control and head for home.
Let's get out of here.
The B-17F was bristling with defensive firepower, utilizing 50 caliber M2 Browning air-cooled machine guns. The ventral and ball turrets each had 2 50 caliber guns, complemented by dual 50 caliber machine guns at the rear, and single 50 caliber machine guns at each waist. The nose sections of armament varied, ranging from a single 30-caliber machine gun from the Bombardier and a 50-caliber machine gun from the Navigator to as many as 4 50-caliber machine guns in upgraded configurations. Additionally, a 50-caliber machine gun was placed for the radio operator's use. Formations were essential in safe passage. A formation multiplies the number of guns that can shoot at the enemy fighters. B-17s, being large four-engine bombers, could survive a lot of punishment. Whereas smaller fighter planes could be taken out by just several hits. And if you would like to fly the B-17 yourself, or any of the other 2,500 tanks, planes, helicopters, and ships the game has to offer, you can with the sponsor of today's video, War Thunder. In War Thunder, the B-17 can be gained as part of the introduction to the world of strategic bombers for the US tech tree. One of the great features in War Thunder that has a direct link to the tactics the USAAF used during the war is that you can fly in a defensive formation to emulate the real-life tactics and effectiveness of the B-17 in War Thunder. You can bring up to 4 friends and fly together, combining your defensive firepower and payload in a manner resembling the original bombing raids during the Second World War. Or take out your inner tanker and advance through the ranks until you have your own Abrams. Fly the B-17 Flying Fortress today. Get into the battle now for free by clicking the link in the description. You'll receive a large bonus pack including multiple premium vehicles, a premium account, and much more. Support the channel and play War Thunder today. With a formation, the sheer number of tracers going in the enemy pilot's direction exerted massive psychological pressure on the fighter pilots. The Germans figured out that attacking from the nose in level flight was less dangerous, due to the fast closing speed and fewer B-17 guns pointing at them. When a gunner spotted enemy planes, even from far away, he would immediately warn the crew via the intercom using the clock system, where all the directions were designated as numbers on the clock, starting from 12, meaning directly in front of the B-17, with 6, meaning directly behind the bomber. So when the crew heard, "Bandits, 6 o'clock high," they knew that enemy fighters would attack from behind and above the B-17, and they could expect the enemy planes to show themselves in their own areas of fire from the specified direction. If a BF-109 attacked from behind, the tail gunner would be the first to spot and warn the others.
"Bandit, 6 o'clock, low."
The upper turret or ball turret would then swing to the rear and be ready to deliver ordnance into the approaching enemy.
"3 o'clock, low."
If 3 o'clock low came over the intercom, the ball turret and right waist gunner would open fire, and the left waist gunner and dorsal turret gunner would be ready to shoot at the enemy fighter as it flew past. Only dorsal and ball turrets had reflector sights. Other gunners used open sights. Even the tail gunner had only a short stick with a ring and an iron open sight that was aimed parallel to his guns. Add to this, in a tight box formation, the heat of battle and growing war weariness, friendly fire was inevitable. While friendly fire between the B-17s in the same box was not uncommon, there are no actual statistics that we could find for the number of incidents. The bomber was powered by 4 Wright Cyclone R-1820-97 radial 9-cylinder air-cooled engines. Each engine was equipped with a turbo supercharger and a 3-bladed propeller featuring controllable blade pitch. If the engine had a fire, malfunctioned, or was damaged enough to stop working, the pilot could turn the engine off completely and feather the propeller to minimize drag. The engines numbered 1 to 4 from left to right from the pilot's perspective, and they were capable of a nominal maximum power of 1,200 horsepower each. However, in wartime emergency power, they could briefly achieve up to 1,380 horsepower.
"Let's speed up and get to the bigger formation."
The aircraft was capable of cruising speeds of up to 200 miles an hour, with a maximum speed of 299 miles per hour at an altitude of 25,000 feet. Remarkably, under WEP, the B-17F could reach speeds of 325 miles an hour at this altitude, but only for a few minutes. The service ceiling reached an impressive 37,500 feet. According to the regulations, a B-17 should be able to fly on just two engines, although sometimes battle damage to the wings and the fuselage forced the crew to bail out when even only one engine was damaged. But there were a few times when planes could limp back, constantly losing altitude, and coming in on a wing and a prayer still do a successful emergency landing with just one engine running. The B-17's main fuel supply came from six tanks distributed across both wings, three per wing, with engines 1 and 4 each being served by one tank, and engines 2 and 3 receiving fuel from two tanks each. To ensure optimal performance and fuel efficiency, an electric pump could pump fuel from one wing to another. In addition, the B-17F was equipped with Tokyo tanks. This was a system comprising of 18 self-collapsible additional tanks, 9 in each wing. These tanks had no dedicated pumps, but instead relied on gravity to transfer fuel to the main tanks. They were placed to balance weight and maintain aircraft stability. When the plane was taking off under maximum weight, all fuel tanks, including the Tokyo tanks, had to be full. This was so the wings were robust enough to deal with the extreme forces of the takeoff. The Tokyo tanks added about 1,080 US gallons to the existing 1,700 US gallons carried in the six regular wing tanks. For missions prioritizing range over bomb load, an auxiliary tank capable of holding 820 US gallons could be mounted in the bomb bay, pushing the total fuel capacity to an impressive 3,600 US gallons. Despite their advantages, the Tokyo tanks had a risk of vapor buildup, which could transform them into explosive hazards under combat conditions. The main tanks had a self-sealing design. This design was a two-layer system of rubber compounds encased in a metal outer shell. The outer shell was made of soft aluminum alloy, inside of which was a container made out of several layers of gasoline-soluble rubber. When the tank was intact, the gasoline-reactive rubber was isolated from the gasoline. If the tank was punctured by a bullet or a shell fragment, the inner sac would bulge under the force of the hit. The rubber around the newly created hole would then expand and close the leak, effectively self-sealing the tank. Due to the thick walls, these tanks had a lower capacity than the unprotected ones, but were significantly safer. The Tokyo tanks lacked an outer metal skin. They were just thick-skinned, self-sealing rubber bags put inside the empty spaces in the wings, from which fuel flowed to the main tanks.
How are we looking? Hydraulics are down.
The aircraft's hydraulic system was deliberately designed to be as minimalistic as possible, operating solely the cowl flaps and the wheel brakes. In contrast, the B-17F leveraged an extensive electrical system, powering the turrets, landing gear, wing flaps, bomb bay doors, and the majority of onboard instruments, ensuring ample power generation during the mission, as long as even one of the engines was running. An auxiliary gasoline-powered generator unit placed in the tail section provided an emergency power source for battery recharging and essential radio operations.
Pilot to navigator, how far is the emergency airfield?
Navigation was a hugely difficult and complicated task. Usually there were only three officers on the plane, the pilot, the co-pilot, and the navigator, highlighting the importance of the role.
Roger, navigator, I have visuals. Good job, Crosby.
The navigator utilized a combination of airspeed, bearing, altitude, relative airspeed, radio bearings, celestial observations, and landmark recognition to ascertain the aircraft's position. By integrating these different techniques, the navigator was able to chart the course on his map. The skill of the navigator was an essential part of the mission's success. The startup procedure for the B-17F Flying Fortress was conducted with the help of a checklist. The pilot would activate the master switch, powering the aircraft's primary electrical systems. The co-pilot would engage the battery switches and inverters, confirming their operational status. With the electrical system on, attention would shift to the aircraft's hydraulic system, specifically the parking brakes. A hydraulic check would be conducted to ensure that the aircraft was stationary during the engine startup, with the pilot verifying the activation and integrity of the booster pumps. The carburetor filters would then be opened, facilitating optimal air intake for engine combustion. The fuel quantity across all tanks was checked. The engines would be started sequentially from number 1 to number 4, with a careful approach to synchronize their operations post-ignition. Following the engine startup, flight indicators and vacuum pressures would be checked for accuracy. Simultaneously, the radio would be activated and the radio operator would confirm that the radio equipment was operational and ready to use. Instrument checks would be performed to ensure that all systems were within operational parameters, followed by a crew report to confirm readiness. The engine run-up phase included locking the brakes, setting the trim tabs, and exercising turbos and props to assess their responsiveness. Generators were then checked and turned off, followed by a thorough run-up of the engines to confirm their performance under increased power. Before takeoff, the tailwheel would be locked to ensure directional stability. The gyro would be set for navigation accuracy, and the generators reactivated, fully powering the aircraft's electrical system. The B-17 was designed with some older concepts in mind, dating back to the late 1920s. The plane could have been made lighter and faster, or with better bomb capacity, at the expense of its great resilience to damage. The structure was difficult to completely break, and with redundant systems, the B-17 was a hard plane to kill. The Germans calculated in 1943 that to bring down one B-17, they needed to hit the aircraft with about 20 20mm shells from behind, or with four specially designed 30mm shells. Considering ammo usage and expected misses, two average German pilots flying Bf-109s would have to pour all of their ammo at a single B-17 to achieve success. In early 1944, Allied fighters started to escort bombers almost to the target, and German fighter losses started to mount. In the last months of 1944, the Luftwaffe was a pale shadow of its former deadly force that American bombers met in 1943. The hopes of the US AAF generals that flying fortresses could successfully defend themselves without fighter escorts were shattered, sadly, with the huge loss of life in 1942 to 1943. On October the 14th, 1943, also known as Black Thursday, the 8th Air Force lost 60 bombers, but in return claimed 288 fighters shot down, though that number is thought to be exaggerated, and in fact, only 40 enemy airplanes were lost. Between 1935 and May 1945, 12,731 B-17s were produced. Of these aircraft, 4,735 were lost during combat missions. As of today, only three B-17Fs remain in existence. Only one of them saw use in combat, and it flew a full 25 combat mission tour over Europe, the Memphis Belle. If you spotted any errors, please let us know in the comments. We're looking to continuously improve. Also, if you like our video, please check out our Patreon. Thank you. Get into the battle now for free by clicking the link in the description. You'll receive a large bonus pack, including multiple premium vehicles, a premium account, and much more. Support the channel and play War Thunder today.